This is Bob Fitragius bringing you the other side of the news.
Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
This is Bob Fitragius here with my guest host and longtime co-conspirator, Harvey Wasserman. And you can listen to this on WGRM LPFM 94.1 and WCRS LPFM 92.7 and 98.3. Decade in review, Harvey.
2010.
What well, went we start. On in the last decade?
Yeah, well, I worked from 2010 to 2020. And the decade has to start with the Citizens United, January 2010, the Supreme Court. Decides that our elections are for sale, officially, legally, all the money you want to pour in, any corporation, to buy any election. Citizens United builds on two decisions in the 70s, just as Nixon was taking over the court, Buckley versus Vallejo in 76, and Bilotti in 78, which was written by Lewis Powell. And these two decisions basically prevented election reform and limitations on campaign spending in a certain form, and then Citizens United.
Well, yeah, the form was if you were acting independent
right.
of the official campaign, you could spend right. unlimited money, essentially.
The birth of the PACs.
It was equated with free speech, yeah.
Right, the birth of the PACs. And those two decisions, coming right after Watergate, you know, the major reform from a president who had Duane Andreas of Archer Daniels Midland walking into the Oval Office with a bag full of $100,000 in cash. There was an attempt to reform the system, and Buckley and Bilotti killed it. And then 2010 comes in and just completely opens the floodgates, followed by McCutcheon, and here we are today with an insane lunatic in the White House.
Well, there was $20 million raised legally by Nixon and $60 million overall. So
right.
he raised three times the amount in illegal money.
Right.
And you remember, of course, Bebe Rebozo, who forgot that he was out shaking people down like the dairy producers. And he forgot he put $250,000 in one suit coat because so much illegal money was coming in.
Right. Well, you got to remember one thing when you think of Richard Nixon. Meyer Lansky always made money for his partners. And that's, you know, Dick Nixon came right out of Meyer Lansky. And, you know, he was a mobster just like Donald Trump. And that's how we go. And these four decisions, Buckley, Bilotti, Citizens United, and McCutcheon are the foundation of the corporate ownership of our government. That's where we're at.
And again, right, Citizens United will never be defeated. Well, they've created it now.
Right.
So the citizens will never be united because of the dark money that is just pouring into our politics.
Right.
We don't know where it's coming from. It could come right out of corporate treasuries.
It probably does, yeah. And you know, and drug dealing, and we have a mafia government. I mean, Donald Trump is the ultimate, you know, we refer to him as President Fredo. He's the ultimate mafia president, and that's the logical corollary for having unlimited money in our taking over our government.
But to some extent, he didn't even need the unlimited money because he got $7 billion or so in
free media.
And I mean, this obsession
right.
with the corporate media, with a guy, you know, who's saying stuff that's counterfactual constantly.
They don't care. You know, they don't care. They don't have to. Trump is just a complete product of a money system gone mad, as was Nixon. You know, Nixon really. You got three guys in the White House who are tied to the mob. You did have the Kennedys, you know, the Kennedy, Joe Kennedy, dad, Papa Kennedy was did go in to Chicago in 1960 with the mob and, you know, basically bought Chicago. And that, but the irony is, and the great irony...
Well, Sam Giancana kind of volunteered some of those districts he controlled over on the west side.
And his girlfriend, Judith Exeter, who was on loan
to... needed a messenger.
On loan to the Kennedys. But the great irony of the 1960 election, there's no doubt that Joe Kennedy went to the mob to throw Chicago to his son. But the irony is that Jack Kennedy would have won the election in 1960 even if he didn't carry Illinois. The general belief is that the mob and Joe Kennedy bought the 1960 election for Jack, and he basically, that was his intent, and he did buy Illinois, but he didn't need Illinois.
Yeah, well, they just rented Illinois if they needed a place.
Well, they had to move those graveyards a little bit. But then, of course, Nixon was a pure mobster. I mean, Nixon was completely locked in with Marwanski and the Florida branch of the mob, and including Santos Traficante and Carlos Marcello, who were both...
The last men standing in the suspects that killed Kennedy.
Right. They were very proud of their role in the assassination of Kennedy, and they were mobsters, these guys. But Jack and Bobby were not really very fond of the mob, as it turns out. That's part of the reason they're both killed. And then Nixon comes in. Nixon's straight organized crime. And Donald Trump's entire career, his entire life, is wrapped up in organized crime.
Money laundering for the Russian mafia.
Yeah, well, it goes deeper than that. I mean, his grandfather, who's an immigrant from Germany, Trump, ran a brothel. I mean, you don't run a brothel without the mob. This is human trafficking. His father, of course, Trump's father, was the big developer in New York City, and you don't pour concrete in New York City without the mob. So Fred Trump, who was a big Ku Klux Klan supporter, was completely linked into the five families, and that's how Donald grew up. His mentor was Roy Cohn, a mob lawyer. And then, of course, as you mentioned, Donald inherits his father's real estate, goes broke, of course, and
shouts, "Where's my Roy Cohn?"
Yes, well, his Roy Cohn was right there at the time.
And now it's Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah, Giuliani, right. It never stops.
He could be so bad, though. He could be the anti-Cohn.
Yeah, right. So Donald goes broke in the 80s and starts laundering Russian money. You know, everybody's, this whole thing about Trump's connection to Putin, Trump owns Putin. I mean, collusion is an understatement. When Trump was pulling himself, was being pulled up by these Russian mobsters, I mean, what happens is when the Soviet Union falls, these guys come out of the gulag, they have their crime organizations already intact, and they take over the Soviet Union, make themselves, have the former Soviet Union. Well, they took it over in the 80s, really, and then knocked off Gorbachev. And then in the 90s, the mob completely takes over the Soviet Russia now under Yeltsin, the CIA guy, and make themselves billionaires. They want to bring their money into the U.S. How do you do that? You find a bankrupt guy with real estate and mob
Hopefully
connections.
Casinos.
Yeah, and casinos and
luxury hotels.
Exactly.
And a developer who can hide a lot of money in building.
Right. And you bring over literally boatloads of rubles, which are worthless, and you pay 10, 20 times the value for these condos, and Trump gets bailed out, and the mobsters own him. And so when Putin comes in 1999, Putin is the mob boss of Russia, and all his sub guys own Trump. And so Putin inherits Trump. And it's a flat-out ownership. This is not collusion. So, Trump is Putin's poodle, basically, you know.
So instead of Putin being the czar, he's the Don.
He's the Don. Well, he's both.
But was it really more the decade of the Koch brothers and Alex?
Yeah.
Even though they're down to one brother this year. But
right.
For a decade, I mean, they wrote most of the legislation at the state level throughout the U.S., right?
Right.
Alec, the American Legislative Exchange Council.
Mm-hmm. Formed in the 70s.
Point and click.
Right. Well, what happens in the 2010 election is that they figured out that Alec and the Koch brothers took a map. It's called the Red Map. And they just picked the districts that they needed to carry to flip the states, one by one by one. And it was called the Red, in my history book, The Spiral of U.S. History, they picked the key districts in the key states, and they took over the redistricting process in 2010. And they flipped the whole election, and they flipped the whole country. And so with Obama, who got in 28, and he had, Obama had control of both houses of Congress. At one point he had 60 senators and, a filibuster-proof majority, basically did nothing except get us into Afghanistan. I mean, they did do HCA, and they did do the stimulus package.
Well, in the previous decade, 2009, he did do the coup in Honduras.
Yes, that's right. And he got
in
us
2011, deeper. Regime change, killed Gaddafi and inflamed the entire North African
started
area.
Started the whole refugee crisis into Europe.
Jihadism.
Right, but, here he gets the Nobel Prize, which I thought was the Nobel Committee trying to bribe him to be peaceful. He gives the.
But he really, to be fair, he got that for a speech he made as a state senator,
right,
running for the U.S. Senate, not for anything he did while being president.
Right. He gives the first pro-war speech in the history of the Nobel Prize. Takes us into Afghanistan. I will tell you, basically, if
well,
if
we were there. He surged it.
He surged it, and he had a choice. He could have pulled us out. Just like Lyndon Johnson in March of 65 had a choice. He could have pulled us out of Vietnam, or he could have escalated. And he escalated and destroyed the country, basically. Our country and Vietnam. And Obama had the same choice. You know, he comes in, he's got the Nobel Prize, and he can either escalate the war in Afghanistan, or he can pull us out. And apparently he didn't read about the Graveyard of Empires. And the dozen major empires, Persia, the Brits, the Russians, whoever else, went into the Sasanians, the Babylonians, everybody who went into Afghanistan was destroyed. So he thinks that we're going to go in there and do better.
He missed that class at Columbia.
So
when he was an undergraduate.
He missed it at Punahou is where he missed it. So, he and Hillary Clinton... they had the option. They could have changed this country if they'd have pulled out of Afghanistan and ended the endless war. Donald Trump would be, sweeping streets in Manhattan right now. I mean, they are the ones, Clinton and Obama, who paved the way for Trump right in the beginning of the decade by getting us deeper into Afghanistan. The stimulus package was a great thing, by the way. He comes in, the economy's crashed, we're about to face a
2009.
Yeah. Right. The world's about to face a global depression. He comes in with the stimulus package. If he had done the stimulus package about five times as big as it was, which he could have done, and if he had whipped the bankers in line the way FDR did, we'd have a very different country. If he'd have been an actual New Dealer instead of just a technocrat who injects the stimulus packages in, walks away.
Well, one of the weirdest things he did is he gave all this money to Chrysler and then sold it to Fiat. And now Chrysler is a highly profitable subsidiary of Fiat. And the only reason Fiat wanted Chrysler was to open dealerships in the U.S.
Yeah. And, Obama in 2009 walks into a room full of bankers and they're terrified, because he's he's bailing them out, and he reads them the Riot Act, and he didn't do anything to them. I mean, one person from the financial community went to jail for the...
wasn't that an Arab-American?
some low-level data entry guy. So, we started the 2010s on a bad note because the promise of Barack Obama, the hope and change, was left unfulfilled.
But was it the decade of climate change? I mean,
Well, then it gets worse. March 11th, 2011, we have Fukushima. And, four American reactors, those are American reactors, blow up. Now, I started...
Well, somebody just wrote us, I sent you it. Someone
claimed
that reactors can't blow up.
Exactly. We you know, when we first started the anti-nuclear movement, the no-nukes movement, in the early 70s, people would go around and all these hippies and we go, you know, we give speeches and oh, the reactor's going to blow up. And the industry would immediately come in, I mean, in a nanosecond, and say, no, it's physically impossible for a commercial reactor to
blow
up. So
that's an old talking point?
Oh, God, yes, right from the start. And you people don't know what you're talking about. It is physically impossible for an atomic reactor to explode. Then Chernobyl blew up. And they said, no, those are Soviet reactors, American reactors. Can't blow up. And then four of them blow up at Fukushima. And we don't hear, well, this guy came out of the woods and said, oh, no, reactor can't blow up, you know, except for those four at Fukushima. I mean, they don't count. There was a tsunami. But, you know, the fact is that there are many people who believe that the first reactor at Fukushima was already melting before the tsunami arrived because of the earthquake. So the one good thing in this decade, we have to make note of this, after the four reactors blew up at Fukushima, there were more than 50 operating reactors in Japan. And God help us, you know, the Fukushima is still pouring radiation into the Pacific. Could be killing the Pacific Ocean as we speak. But the other reactors in Japan went down and have not reopened. I think they've got 7 or 8 or 9 operating in Japan now. But thankfully, we've had a decade where the Japanese reactors basically have not been operating, thank God. So, and it also had a huge impact on Europe. In fact, there was a great story, you know, it was a very powerful anti-nuclear green movement in Germany, and they had called for a demonstration in early 2011, and between the time that they called for the demonstration and the time the demonstration happened, Fukushima happened, and Angela Merkel, who is a chemist, she has a scientific background, said, you know what, I'm convinced, and they put this plan in effect, which has dominated the decade in Germany, to phase out all their nuclear and all their coal, oil, and gas. So in the 2010s, Germany has been in progress to going 100% renewable. And this is not some hippie country. This is the fourth largest economy in the world, and it's been extremely successful. You hear a lot of, you know, propaganda about this and that and blah, 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 and they claim, the pro-nukers claim that whenever a nuclear reactor shuts, we burn more coal and gas, and that turns out to be true because the utilities choose to do that. They don't want the renewables to come in. All nuclear plants, and we learned this in the 2010s, all nuclear plants, all coal, all oil, and all gas, or what I call King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, can all be replaced by renewables. Cheaper, cleaner, safer, more reliable. So that's a big lesson from the 2010s.
But what about the Deepwater Horizon blowout, which they said they couldn't anticipate it with the quick drying concrete, but it had already blown out.
Right.
In off Azerbaijan, right in the Caspian Sea.
Well, this was,
which is Greg Palast's point.
Yeah,
as they out perjured themselves before Congress.
Well, as we've seen, that perjury is just kind of like a recreational sport for these guys. The Deepwater Horizon was a pet project of Dick Cheney, and you know, God knows what has happened to the Gulf of Mexico over the 2010s. It's not pretty. You know, like the rest of our global ecology, and we're in deep trouble.
But we don't need to drill. We can do it with renewables.
Totally, the 2010s technologically could be remembered as the decade that renewable energy just completely took over the marketplace. It's one of the most thorough and astounding technological revolutions in the history of the human race. I mean, you went from wind and solar being like fringy, hippie, you know, who cares technologies, to the dominant energy producing technologies in the world. Far more money is being invested by big capital in wind and solar than any other form of generation, power generation. And of course, with the rise of Elon Musk and Tesla, you know, in the 2020s, we will transition entirely to electric vehicles, totally. I mean, you will, in 2030, I'll tell you right now, in 2030, you'll not be able to buy a gas-powered car, not only because they'll be illegal, but also because they'll be completely outstripped. I mean, people are now building these super-fast hot rods, completely electric. A gas-fired race car cannot compete with an electric-powered race car. I mean, they are zoom. So that's a big thing that's happened in the 2010s. And the fruition, if our species makes it, which is really, you know, a question at this point, by 2030, we will not be burning any fossil fuels anywhere.
But the 2010s, though, in many ways, were the decade of fracking.
Fracking is, you know, if you want to define the human race committing suicide, fracking is it. I mean, and you know, here in Ohio, where we're recording, fracking is huge along with Pennsylvania. Josh Fox has done great work on this, but fracking is a horrible nightmare, horrible. But you've seen the coal. Coal has really gone pretty much. We still have uses for oil in the vehicular industry, and that's going to go away. But coal in the 2010s pretty much is on its way out very rapidly, actually. So that's a big plus. But you know, I think in the 2010s we had to confront the reality that the human race might not make it. You know, we faced that with the atomic bomb. Thankfully, they haven't gone off. People have not figured out how dangerous nuclear power is. I think, unfortunately, we're going to have more meltdowns, more explosions, and they are apocalyptic. But this is the first time now, with ecological reasons and with this wave of extinctions, that we are looking very seriously at the possibility that we're just not going to make it. The human species is just not going to be able to sustain on this planet.
But what do we make of the rise of nationalism in Europe and in the United States, and these mass shootings, the rise of white supremacy, white nationalists?
Well, we got a tough transition here. You know, the I blame it basically on the failure of the corporate Democrats to deliver real social change.
Well, and, what they delivered were Republican policies, right? Neoliberal free trade, right, and neoconservative foreign policy.
Well, in researching my history of the United States, I really had to come grips to my spiral of U.S. history. I had to come to grips with how bad the Clintons really were. I mean, in 1992, you have, in the 1990s, to go back two decades, you had two of the greatest economic windfalls ever to come to the United States, the end of the Cold War and the computer revolution. I mean, we should have been the richest country. Well, we were the richest country the world had ever seen. The Clintons are elected with the promise of social change, and they come in there and, you know, they triangulate. They play the diversity card, but they don't deliver any. So you cannot look at the 8 years of Bill Clinton's presidency and point to a single lasting social program that he put into place. You know, Bill Clinton's sole contribution to the American dialogue was a national discussion of oral sex. I mean, it's the only thing that came out of the Clinton administration. He did one thing. He did broker the peace in Northern Ireland, which is great, and he should have got the Nobel Prize for that. But forget about the rest of it. I mean, they were completely worthless. And then
96, he ran on putting 1 million more police on the street.
Yeah, exactly.
He federalized the drug war.
Exactly. They put put between 600,000 and 800,000 additional people into American prisons. It was the biggest jump in the prison population in the history of the United States, from 1.2 to 2 million.
Worse than Nixon's war on drug and zero tolerance from Ronald Reagan?
Well, you know, Nixon just got it started. You know, and Nixon was very, you know, we've got that great quote from John Ehrlichman. The Nixon administration was very clear internally that they couldn't have cared less about marijuana, and they knew perfectly well that marijuana was not a dangerous drug. It was just an herb, and there's not a single recorded instance of anybody dying from an overdose of marijuana. All that was happening was they went to the grocery store, ripped into the cupcake section, and got overweight from smoking too much pot. But, you know, they knew that the war on drugs was the biggest disenfranchisement campaign in American history in the 20th century anyway, dating back after slavery and after Jim Crow in the South. It was, as Michelle Alexander said, the new Jim Crow. So the whole drug war was a pretext to deprive the black and young youthful communities of the right to vote, and Hispanics.
Which is what Ehrlichman, as you pointed out, said it was.
Exactly. And then, you know, 41 million arrests, $1 trillion, and what they did was they kept the black vote at bay. But 2010, what happens now in the 2010s, is the rise of the millennials. And this is what's critical in American history, and this is what hopefully will define the politics of the 2020s. The millennial generation, born from the early 80s to the early 2000s, is 85 million people. It's bigger than the baby boom, especially now that all the baby boomers are dying off. You know, so and the entire politics of the 2020s is going to have to be set by the millennials. That's why the corporate Democrats are who really have to be overcome. The corporate Democrats selling this sort of moderate, you know, BS. If you look at the Clintons, Al Gore, John Kerry, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, you know, the whole...
Obama, who keeps pointing out that he's now not mentioning who should run, but talking about moderate policies.
But, the corporate Democrats, basically, in the 1990s, we were looking at two revolutions. 1960s, actually, we were looking at two revolutions. We're looking at ending the empire. This is for the baby boomers. Ending the empire and transforming the culture. And we did transform the culture.
The counterculture pretty much won, didn't it?
We won. Absolutely, we won. It took 50
years. Sexuality.
Right.
Drugs.
Transgender, race, feminism. The baby boomers did transform the culture, but we got nowhere with the empire. And that's what the millennials are getting.
But what do we make of the last decade and the Me Too movement?
Great.
Is that, you know...
It's a great thing. It's a transitional point from the baby boomers to the millennials. And, you have the squad in Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and younger people, you know, homosexuality is no longer an issue. You've had a campaign for the presidency by a gay guy.
As the millennial bumper sticker says, mean people suck. So telling someone who they should love is just mean.
It's just mean. So that part has changed. It's not a total victory, obviously. You still got plenty of reactionary cultural stuff out there. But
well, it's being fought out in the court system, the Supreme Court.
Right.
Can private employers discriminate against... lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans.
Right, and you have gay marriage approved by a conservative judge from San Francisco, Kennedy, who then left the court, but here we go. So, I mean, if you told us in the 1960s that gay marriage would be as accepted as it is, we'd have said, wow. You know, but here we go. So we're moving it forward, but now it's the empire, and now it's social justice, and now it's the environment, and that's where we're at.
The last word on this decade and the coming decade?
It's up to the millennials. The millennials have to do to the empire what the baby boom did to the culture.
You heard it here on the other side of the news.
Death and hatred to mankind. Poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.